Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, Producer's Picks. Highlights the best What's Next episodes heard recently. On today's show, we'll hear segments from three standout episodes, starting with...
There's this attack against Black history. But even before that attack, it wasn't like Black history was being taught in any kind of robust, comprehensive way.
A conversation with Dr. Marcus Watson, Jay Phillips, and Jadon Williams from Buffalo State. We'll then move over to...
Sometimes mental health, it's a big stigma. You think of like someone who may be in a psych ward or something like that. But just everyday life challenges, we want to have those conversations.
A sit down with LaShawn Davis and Deja Middlebrook of Walking Through Solutions, LLC. And we'll close with...
Buffalo has a lot of really cool quirks, and the resiliency of the people that live here is just amazing.
A conversation with Pat Cray, a Buffalo-based photographer. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in. First, we revisit a conversation on preserving Black history and identity. We welcome three individuals from Buffalo State to speak on the topic with E. Jazz Jaseel. Dr. Marcus Watson, an associate professor of Africana Studies at Buffalo State University, and two then seniors, Jay Phillips and Jadon Williams.
You, Jay, and Jadon, looking into the current generation, I feel like in recent years there's become more of a distinction between Black culture and African culture, and even sort of identity, who's allowed to identify as Black, who's allowed to identify as African American. How do you feel there can be an embracing and an acknowledgement of Black culture without straying from our African roots and history?
Yeah, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. I think that there has been like a lot of discourse on social media, especially about the difference and like who's better, and a lot of discourse about like Black people not having any culture or history.
Definitely.
And I think that we need to acknowledge Black history and Black culture, but within that we also need to acknowledge African history and African culture. And I think that we're just kind of, it's that unbalanced thing again, where Black people don't know about the history and culture within Africa, and then Africans may come over, they might stay in Africa, and they're like, okay, well, y'all didn't come from anywhere, y'all don't know anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that we need to kind of connect with that thing where it's like, okay, African thought, what is it to have those conversations, those needed conversations between each other? Because I feel like we're going up against so many different systems of oppression, really the same ones. And I think that when we have those conversations together about what we're going through, I think that a lot of that disconnect will be eliminated, because we're going through the same mm-hmm. things. I think that history isn't teaching us that. Society isn't teaching us that. What the media is like forcing down us. Like we're just totally misunderstanding each other. And I think that it's because of a lack of connection and lack of conversation and a lack mm-hmm. of community. So I hope that the conference really brings that together as well.
Yes. I definitely feel like it is the lack of community within our generation, especially with culture, because it's like, African Americans don't have any culture. Why? Maybe ask yourself, why do we don't have any culture? One, we were stripped from our land and brought to a country to be slaves. It's like, what is our culture necessarily when you're in imprisonment? Like, we don't have any. We have culture. One, I want to start off by saying that.
Definitely.
Because we have culture. So it's not even like we're gonna say we don't have culture, but just because necessarily your culture is more.
It's been there for years.
Been there for years.
Yes.
And it's like, your ancestors were kept in Africa, my ancestors were brought to America. Like, it's just like, I feel like at the end of the day, we're Black. Like, we gotta remember that at the end of the day, like Jay said, we have more bigger fish to fry. Like, mm-hmm. there's so many things that are set up against us, but we're worried about who doesn't have more culture. Like,
right, then they both black. Who's not?
Yeah, because when they don't, nobody cares about your culture when they're looking at your skin color. Like,
exactly. Because yeah. when you come over here, it's like they're gonna look at you and you're gonna be black, and yeah. it doesn't matter if you came from the islands. It doesn't matter if you came from the continent. Mm-hmm. If you came from the UK, like at the end of the day, we're really all black, and I think that we just really need to appreciate each other more.
And I feel like it's more like an American thing as well, because when you go and travel outside of the world, like, nobody cares about you being black. Like, it's yeah. just like more of an American thing. So I feel like that's part of American culture as well. It's like the ignorance of Americans as well. So I just feel like as people, like Dr. Watson said, like, as humanity, we have a lot to learn within ourselves and yeah. and within our own groups, within our own cities, within our even our own family. Like, we have a lot to learn. Like, you can learn a lot from within, and I feel like just tapping into your culture from family, like, is just necessary. You don't gotta have culture just because you see somebody else, like, necessarily, like, broadcasting it. Like, you could find your culture within yourself as well.
That's a great point. And
can I add something?
Please. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with what both these young scholars have said. I think we not only do we have culture, but I think it's an African-based culture, and I think we just don't know it.
Yeah.
You know, and that goes back to this point about history. Right. So there's this attack against black history, but even before that attack, it wasn't like black history was being taught in any kind of robust, comprehensive way. Right. I'm a university professor. I teach incoming first year students in my Introduction to Africana Studies course. And almost to a one, they're shocked by everything they learn in. So whatever education they had until that point, and that's not in Florida or Texas, that's New York State. They don't know. So I think not only do we have culture, but it is an African based culture. And because of our amnesia about history, we just don't remember it or know it, right? The late historian and great ancestor John Henrik Clark said it this way, that we focus too much on where the ships took us to,
not where it's from,
and not as much on where they took us from. Uh-huh. Right? And I think that's intentional. So we're concerned about our zip code that we're at, or the island we're on, or in some strange way, even the African country that they containerized us in over the last 50 or 60 years, right? And when we focus on the destination, where the ships took us to, then we're focusing on our differences. Right? And I think that's important. I'm from Chicago, I'm from Buffalo, I'm from Rochester, I'm from Jamaica, I'm from this and that. We focus on our differences. And it's not that those things aren't real, but balance seems to be a theme, right? when we're 100% on that side of things, we lose sight of the commonality. Where did the ships take us from, right? And when a light can be shed on that, I think what will be illuminated is that there are a lot of Africanisms in Black American culture.
Definitely.
That's very true. You know, even things like language, religion, you know,
dance,
so many.
Music.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You can look at, you know, the things that they do in Africa and see so many parallels of, oh, okay, I see where our modern dance and music originated from. And I think, you know, you mentioned a very good point earlier, too, about how it's really, you know, an American thing, if you think about it. It's such a big deal for us, not to go too far off subject, but the South African singer Tyla, everyone was in an uproar when she didn't identify as black. You know,
she said she was colored, like.
Yeah, a lot of people said.
It's a whole different world over there, like.
Yeah. So, you know, and then even looking in, as you just said, Dr. Watson, the fact that even in somewhere like Buffalo, black culture varies. What it means to be black in Buffalo is different from what it means to be black in Rochester, or what it means to be black in Buffalo on the east side is different than what it means to be black in Buffalo in Amherst. So, you know, when you look at a conference like Black Buffalo Speaks, that's literally bringing everyone together, and not just everyone from black cultures, but from the city. And I know I think balance really is the theme of the day, but, you know, how does something like this help us to restore our sense of togetherness and that interconnectedness that ultimately does bring us together, the invisible thread, so to speak.
Yeah, honestly, I'm about to call it three C's. Community, conversation, and what else I said? Community, conversation, connection.
Connection.
Yeah, I think that that's just what we need right now. And I hope that the conference really pulls that out of us.
Yeah, I think it is. I feel like it definitely is. Especially like now, what's going on in the world, like we need each other more than we ever do right now. Like, just we got to stick together. So even if this conference brings people from Buffalo into our campus and people that probably are staying over the summer, they rekindle with each other. You go find out about different things that's happening in the city. Like, I feel like it's just going to bring a lot of community within each other, because like I said, me being up here 4 years, I really didn't know anything like about Buffalo or what was happening. So this is like really an eye opener for me, because even like meeting, like I said before, meeting a lot of these great people, it was so amazing, because now when I drive on the east side and I'm driving past all of the great faces, I could say, oh, I met one of the artists that did that. Like, it's just so much culture, like, that's already within Buffalo. And like that just, like, it's just so crazy, because me being a outsider, not knowing this, just imagine how many other people within the city of Buffalo that's here that doesn't know about it. So it's it's just teaching the youth as well, and just letting people know about their community as well. And like Buffalo's dope, like, it's cool.
Yeah.
And maybe another theme of the conversation is history. You know, if we need to learn these lessons from history, and I think this conference shows, at least we have, we had Martin R. Delaney against Frederick Douglass, right? They were supposed to be pitted against each other. Africana Studies is saying, we're all on the same side. Mm-hmm. We love all of you. There can be different approaches to that. We had Du Bois and Garvey at each other's throats in their lifetime. We're saying, no, there's a better way. We'll take all of what you have, you know. Yeah. King and Malcolm X, same thing, right? So we take those lessons from history, as long as we know history, mm-hmm. Right. And we say, at least as Africana Studies at Buffalo State, I don't know if the organizations we invited have relationships with each other, mm-hmm. Right? But our point is, we love all of y'all, mm-hmm. You know? It's not that we're a member of this organization or that organization, but hey, if you are helping clean up a neighborhood, let us know. We can do that. If you need an infusion of youth at a particular event you're holding, you know, some of us might be interested in doing that, and mm-hmm. So on and so forth. So that's one of the things we hope that Africana Studies is leaving, right, for us to really consider, which is, can we work together, or does one of these organizations have the right answer and nobody else, mm-hmm. Right? We don't believe that, right?
Nope.
We each have a different angle. We support those angles. Let's work together and see what we can do.
Because we all have one common goal, and that's to make Buffalo better. Yeah. So if we all have the same goal, like, let's work together, let's get it done, and let's move us forward.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's a great point, because I've spoken with a few folks from different local organizations, and I've been surprised to hear it, how much almost bickering there is between organizations. People you would think would have the same common goal, mm-hmm. And, you know,
just
you're wondering.
Like an entitlement.
Yeah. So when you look at that and, you know, you ask, can we work together? Then it becomes like quite a literal question. Can we work together? Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times we've seen some of the greatest downfalls in the Black community, in America in general, because of our sort of inner division. How can we, I think that's a very loaded question to ask, how can we overcome that? But I guess to start, you know, what do you think is some of the, where do we begin to repair it, I guess?
I would like to say, like, something Dr. Watson mentioned one time in class that really stood out to me. Like, when you're learning in school about, like, the civil rights movement and everything, they always, like, focus on one specific group. But Dr. Watson pointed out one time in class, and it always stuck with me. He was like, what about the group that wanted to stick together and keep their Blackness and didn't want to be accepted into society? So I always think about that, like, what about the people that all have the same idea but necessarily don't want to go within, follow the crowd and push for something that they necessarily don't want? Because at the end of the day, yeah, we fought for equality, but what was the cost of that as well? Because we were accepted into these rooms and everything, but then we faced a lot of backlash or a lot of discriminatory, like a lot of just a bunch of different, like, hardships we face in these communities once we're accepted. But what about the people that were like, no, why don't we stick together? Why don't we build our own schools? Why are we so eager to be into these white schools when we could build our own? I just feel like it's within the community. Like, we have to come together as one and just put our thoughts and our minds together, because if necessarily, like, the norm isn't always right. Like, it's always something different that can be successful any type of way. So I feel like once you put different mindsets and different thoughts together, it builds a stronger force. And especially, like, in a community like Buffalo, where it's a lot of redlining and everything else that affects the community that a lot of people don't necessarily know about, it's like when you put these thoughts together, you could build, like, a powerful, like, nation, I feel like.
Yeah.
And if I could add a little something, again, we in Africana Studies, we want, as to the extent possible, to reference African-based ideas and concepts. So I spent 5 years of my life in South Africa among Tsonga speakers. And one thing they say is that it's important, kulehisambilu. Kulehisambilu, it means to lengthen the heart. And when you talk to people about it, what they mean is, we can each expand our hearts to take in more, you know, things that were previously, you know, it didn't feel right to us. We gotta open past that. So it's not about some of us, let's say African descended people, want to go the way of integration and being a part of, and others are more of a self-help to both. You know, we have to lengthen our heart. We're all in a situation that is challenging, to say the least. And so if some of us want to say, I think this is the best way, let's see how that might bring us some value. You know, if you get in and you can help democratize a space, right, that makes it more comfortable for all of us, let's see how that works. If you think that a self-help kind of program is the way, give it a try. Like, what Africana Studies is here for it, you know, to support it all, to lengthen the heart. So I think that is a way for it. When we start getting messages of division and no, I can't do that, we know that's the enemy in a way, in a manner of speaking, right? We know that's the thing that comes to divide, and we should ignore that and say, no, we're not going for the division this time. It's all okay, right? In some manner of speaking, we're all victimized in some kind of way and doing the best we can under tremendously difficult circumstances. And so let's give each other a hand, almost no matter what you know, approach or method we're doing. Maybe not every single.
That was Dr. Marcus Watson, Jay Phillips, and Jadon Williams of Buffalo State University. We'll now revisit a conversation with Deja Middlebrook and LaShawn Davis of Walking Through Solutions, LLC. They sit down with Jay Moran to discuss their ongoing Walking Through Solutions Wednesdays mental health series.
This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR, and this is What's Next. My name is Jay Moran. With me, a couple of familiar guests with us from Walking Through Solutions, Deja Middlebrook. Deja, hi.
Thank you for having me.
Always great to have you along. And LaShawn Davis, great to have you.
Thank you for having us.
Always a pleasure. First, we got to start off with the congratulations to Deja Middlebrook, because Deja just passed the New York State bar exam.
Thank you. Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes.
Congratulations on that. Thank you. We could probably talk about that the whole show, but that's not why you guys came here. You got to keep in mind also, not only is Deja got her JD, but she also has her LMSW, just like mom.
Yes.
And LMSW stands for?
Licensed Master Level Social Worker.
Yes. And of course, Walking Through Solutions, you guys are, well, LaShawn, I guess you're the founder, right? Is that fair enough to say?
Yes.
What prompted you to start it?
Just felt there was a need for more counselors of color. That was my passion. I just really wanted to help. A lot of services were for people who were of a lower income, and I really wanted to help those be aware of mental health that were in a middle income or a higher income, let them know that services was out there for them.
It's interesting how you say be aware. The awareness was low before. It's increasing, you believe?
Yes, I do. And it was a stigma with it. You know, mental health is for people who have life struggles or not surviving in life, where I wanted, you know, everyone deals with mental health struggles. every family, every person. So I just wanted to put it out there and give the education on it, because a lot of people don't know. They assume, even like students I work with are like, oh, something's wrong with these people. And I'm like, no, everybody has mental health.
Right, right. So and so that it's good to see that it's there. And through that mission, of course, it brings us to why one of the reasons why you're here is that you're going to bring community conversations into the East Side. I mean, obviously, it's been a big part of what you've been doing, but but in this particular case, in the month of May, which is what, Mental Health Awareness Month, you've got a series of conversations coming up on the East Side. Let's talk about that.
Yes, we have our Walking Through Solution Wednesdays, which is coming up.
Yes.
And we are partnering with other entrepreneurs to come in and talk about their expertise. We also started off with our, we are partnered with University of Buffalo School of Social Work and the City of Buffalo, who has allowed our interns to work with us, both of us and the city. And they have worked with families. They work, they've done groups.
They
worked under us. Yes, they did a lot of research. So we're going to start to kick off with them so they can talk about what they've learned and how they've learned more about trauma-informed care and how to push it out to the community.
Yeah, so the kickoff is a five-part series. The kickoff is going to be free. We want to make sure that everyone can come to here to showcase our interns. It's like their capstone to show this is what they've done for the city, this is what they've learned individually, and then how you can apply it in your day-to-day life if you're working with youth or families. And even just at home in general.
Right.
But the five-part series, we've partnered, like she said, with a lot of local entrepreneurs to add some other voices to the conversation, people who they specialize in, are experts in those specific topics. And it ranges because, just like my mom said, my business partner mom.
We've already broken the, moved behind the curtain here of the relationship.
sometimes mental health, it's a big stigma. You think of like someone who may be in a psych ward or something like that. But just everyday life challenges. We want to have those conversations of how can mental health affect you. If you have a physical illness, you go to a doctor. So we want to make sure, normalize it, that like, okay, if I'm having some financial stress, if I'm having postpartum, if I'm having, you know, a life transition, who can I talk to? And is this normal? What are the red flags, green flags, and when I should talk to someone?
The first installment, I call it installment, the first conversation, trauma-informed care?
Yes.
Let's break that down. I mean, in some ways the term has its own meaning, but I want to make sure that we get the meaning across here. What are we talking about?
We want to let the community know that, and we want to provide a safe space in the community. We want to increase the community to be a safe space for mental health to be discussed, to empower individuals who do come out and say, I need therapy, I need to talk to someone, to give them the opportunity to create the knowledge that they gain from it and be able to share within a community and to collaborate with others. So once you realize, you know, I need a safe space where I can come and talk to somebody, I'm dealing with a lot of trauma from my past and I don't know where to channel that, we give them that opportunity to build trust within the community, within our organization and the community, and have peer support. So once they learn it's okay to deal with your whatever you're dealing with, whatever trauma you have, that they can help other people who are in the same boat deal with it.
Yeah.
When I saw trauma-informed care, and I couldn't overlook that you're going to be at the Exchange of Beverly Gray, which is literally a stone's throw from the Jefferson Avenue Tops.
Yes.
And of course, we're coming up on the anniversary of 5/14/2022. I'm wondering if you can maybe give me some of your impressions about how that, if in fact that event is still impacting the community. What can you tell me without, obviously you don't want to be breaking, you know, privacy issues here, but what can you tell me what you're seeing and hearing?
I'm glad that you brought it up because I know 5/14 was a big driving factor of why we really honed in on our business and pushed the conversation of mental health. She was right there on the scene providing mental health services to people who were impacted. And even over the years, it's a few years away, but the community still feels it. You still feel that trauma there. And then how do we have those conversations, especially in this polarized environment? We want to make sure that, one, with this conversation that we're doing, we wanted to make sure that it was accessible so people can get there. It's right there, right at Jefferson and East Utica. Right. We wanted to make sure it's accessible to that community, but everyone else as well, but yeah. Very focused on that community. We wanted to make sure that it's affordable. So the first one is free. The other ones are $10 because we want to make sure that people are invested in coming.
Sure.
But we don't want it to feel like, oh, I can't afford to come and I really need to be here.
Right. Right.
And we also have talk with Zanetta Everhart, who her son was part of it, mm-hmm. and dealt with it, and this is her district, and her passion is so strong in that district and regarding the 514 situation. So we have talked to her, and we've partnered with her as well
for her Black Caucus last year. We did some tabling. We and also are part of the Black Mental Health Response Team through Best Self Behavior Health. So we've been in the community providing services, because and some of it is non-traditional services, because mm-hmm. we really want to help people be able to access us and then kind of get there, open the door to say, hey, I want to talk to someone, and it wasn't so bad. And then they may build that trust to say, oh, this is really what's going on with me, or this is how it's impacting me.
And you mentioned, as you were talking about it, polarized environment. In this polarized environment, I know what when I hear that, I know what I'm thinking, this national political philosophical divide that we have. That's what you're referring to? You're seeing that play out?
I see that, but I also see it's a racial disconnect. I know it's hard to talk about race now with the national climate.
Sure.
We don't want to say it's a disproportionate impact, but for things like this, especially when you think about 514, it is a racial factor to it.
No doubt.
And so we really want to talk about the elephant in the room when we are in spaces, because sometimes you're just scared to bring it up because you don't know how other people are going to respond.
Yeah, how it's going to affect them. But for the 514, when that incident happened, it was very limited clinicians of color.
Right.
So I had already started walking through solutions, but it really, for Deja, for myself being there, and for Deja, we just like, we got to do something different.
We need to do more,
This community needs clinicians of color. They need clinicians, period. So,
but it's so important, right? It's so important to have, right? We heard about that right after 514.
Yes.
There were a lot of people were seeking counseling, and just the opportunities to meet somebody who looked like themselves,
right,
who understood their experience, just wasn't there.
Right. And that's what the people said they wanted.
Sure.
So we did a lot of listening to see what the needs were, and that was a big outpour after 514, is they want to see people that look like them.
Yeah, because they had a lot of support. Like, crisis services came out. They had a lot of support, but it was just with that specific situation, they really needed to be able to open up and be vulnerable with someone that they felt looked like them.
And are you seeing that in your other, I mean, you guys are involved in a lot of different efforts, and but are you seeing that people are coming to terms with that they feel safe, that they're able to express maybe some of these thoughts about, you know, race and trauma?
I think so. I think with a lot of the clients that we have been engaged with, they have been able to open up, and we've been more open because we've worked, you know, we've been in the field for so long. And I think anybody who is a therapist can help, but I think we have to build the trust. You know, you need to be able to open up and trust a therapist, because all the work is coming from you. It's not coming from the therapist. They're just guiding you.
I can appreciate that. But as you were saying that, I'm going to dig a little personal here, and you can avoid this if you want, or dodge, or just tell me that you don't want to talk about it. But yeah, I'll go for it. But you are the therapist, and you were there at 514.
Yes.
How about for you? How do you process that?
Well, for me, it was really, really hard because when people did get me to come in, you know, when they came into my office, it was less like a relief for them, because they felt like they weren't hurting anybody just from being angry as it was a racial incident. So for me, I was like, I just really wanted to be there for them. It was hard for me because, you know, you're like, wow. And so I think I did struggle with that, because I'm like, you know, where are the clinicians of color? Because they need to be here. They need to be able to hold on to these people who have just dealt with this. So I think it was hard. I know it was hard. It was really hard for me, but I also appreciated everyone that came out, because they weren't like, okay, it doesn't have anything to do with color. I just want to be here to help you.
So the support made a difference.
Yes.
That's great to hear. I mean, because I mean, I think that was one of the things. We saw a lot of activity on Jefferson for a month, 2 months, and it obviously continued, but it went away. But at least that initial support, that show of support did have benefits.
Right. And it stayed with us. That was like, oh, we got to really make walking through solutions because this is a problem and we need to find a solution. And I think it made us reach out to other clinicians of color as well that we have connect with and, you know, try to keep them on a path.
And more collaborations for referrals, just that relationship building. And that's what we do in all of our professional spaces. But when we have someone that has a need, we've been able to get a lot of opportunities where bigger organizations are being more responsive to the need of people saying, I would like someone that is from this background or that background. I mean, it may be it's religious preferences. It's all different preferences.
Okay, that's a good point,
But when it came to race, a lot of times that wasn't something that they would make a conscious effort to say, oh, you want someone, you know, from your racial background. So now they built more of these directories.
Yes.
That Brown Bag, they launched their Black Wellness Directory a few months ago. And that has like all different, it's not just therapy. They have like yoga. They have like all different like wellness services that's provided by people of color, if that's what you're looking for.
Right.
Are we seeing, are we seeing more people though of color perhaps finding their way into this profession? Or not necessarily seeing that yet?
I would say from our two, so we have two interns of color.
Okay.
That we had this year. Mm-hmm. And we've asked them, because I know I went to, when I went to grad school a few years ago, it was two of us, three total in my classes. And that was kind of interesting because when you think of social work, I think it's a noble profession, but it doesn't, you don't always think like, oh, it's as competitive as like a going to like medical school or something like that.
Or
law school. You're like, okay,
you
were like, if you're interested in it, you should have the opportunity. But then when you look at like, well, why aren't there, you know, people of different communities being accepted, whether it's, you know, Black, Asian, Hispanic, all those things, the diversity just wasn't there. And that's what made me think like, is there some systemic barriers? Is there a lack of access, a lack of awareness of like, this is something that people want? Do people want to do this? And do they have the opportunity to do it?
Right.
Are there barriers?
Some of it, I mean, social work is an extensive program. You have to do an internship. So you have to do two internships. You're doing 16 hours a week and it's unpaid.
Hmm.
So that's on top of your graduate classes. Mm-hmm. So when you think of it, that's a full 4 day week of not being paid. Can you afford to do that for 2 years? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah,
right.
Especially if you have a family, you have to work. You know, so it's like, where do I find a time to work, to do my internship and to do my papers and my schoolwork that's needed and attend classes?
And the starting salaries for some social workers, at least when I graduated, I was like, I could work at Burger King and make more than that.
Come on.
So now I think the conversation is shifting and you see more agencies making more investment because they want you to have a master's degree. They want you to have a license. And you're like, well, if I have to have all of this, I should get paid.
Sure. Professionally.
So I think it is changing. I think as a society, we're making more of an investment in mental health globally, but it's still work to go.
Yeah, because I graduated 20 years ago, 21 years ago, and we had less than a handful of minorities in our graduating class as well. So for her to say it was like a few, we pretty much the same.
Well, that could have we could have a whole conversation about change and what hasn't changed, right?
But
we're gonna continue our conversation this morning on what's next with us, Deja Middlebrook and also LaShawn Davis. They are with Walking Through Solutions. We're talking about their Walking Through Solutions Wednesdays. You mentioned how you're also working with other businesses, other entities as well. Who are some of those that are going to be helping you out and taking part in these conversations? Well, I'll move on and maybe we can have a conversation about each topic. Go ahead, LaShawn.
Our next one, we have Money on the Mind, Reducing Financial Stress.
Whoa.
And that'll be May 21st.
Yes. And that'll be May 21st at 5:30. And that's Melanie Hicks will be presenting.
Okay.
And she also has a book out that she'll talk about. But
Financial Sense.
And her goal is to help people understand budgeting, like how to budget, what to think about, how to figure out planning for it, a family, yourself, just for your retirement, all of it.
Credit, all of that. And then especially with this economy, with inflation and everything, like that causes a lot of stress that people don't really associate it with mental health. They associate it with, you know, work pressures. But that affects your mental health. So we want to bring that to the conversation and we'll have, you know, tailor it to mental health as well. But just to have that expert to talk about how can you reduce some of that financial stress.
Okay. All right.
And our next one we have is
May 28th.
And that is, are you struggling with life after loss? And we have Mercedes Godfrey who's coming in. And she has a very unique, powering story that she will share. And she has other events that she does. She does grief counseling. Oh. And she is Keep On Walking.
Okay. All right.
And then our finale is June 4th, which is Male Vulnerability, Strength or Weakness. Mm-hmm. We'll have Rasheen Powell. Yep, so he's going to come, and he's the expert. He works with plenty of men, and he does his men groups that talks about vulnerability, manhood, all those things. So balancing that pressure, and then how to tune in and hone into your vulnerability. So that's for men, but it's also for women, too, because we experience men. We want to make sure that if men are doing the work to become more vulnerable, we have to do the work to make sure that we're receiving it as well.
Right. We have to be open, and we have to know once they open up to us and they're vulnerable with us, how can we receive it and how can we encourage them to keep going? Keep on being vulnerable.
That was Deja Middlebrook and LaShawn Davis of Walking Through Solutions, LLC. We'll now close out today's show with the conversation Maria Ta had with Pat Cray, a Buffalo-based photographer. The two discussed the value of representation in arts and media.
So tell me, Pat, how you even got started as a photographer. Have you always taken photos? You really like taking photos? You fell into it? What's that about?
I've always wanted to take photographs from like a young age. I grew up skateboarding, so like reading Thrasher magazine and Skateboard Mag and like seeing the ads, I was always just like, oh, this would be super cool if I could like take these photos. I was never really that great of a skateboarder, so I was just like, what's the next pocket that I could fall into? but the price of entry for photography has always been very, very expensive, so it's been kind of difficult for a lot of people to get into, especially me. My mom was not going to invest $1,000 or $1,500 into me getting a camera. So that dream kind of like squalished a little bit from like an early age, but I've always enjoyed photography and like really wanted to be a part of photography. But yeah, when I decided to hop into photography, it was during COVID. I kind of was just like roaming around taking pictures throughout the community on my cell phone, and those photos kind of got a little bit of trajectory and like some traction underneath them, and people were like, yo, we really like what this guy does. So people were like trying to buy prints from me off of like cell phone photos, and I was like, I should probably invest into a camera, and made the investment. And it's been a hard addiction ever since.
Wow. So you started on cell phone photos? Like beginning work was on an iPhone?
Yeah, it was iPhone 6 Pro, 6 Plus. Yeah, it was iPhone 6 Plus.
Wow. Okay, so I know your style is really distinct. I think a lot of people, if they see a picture, they might not know it's you specifically, but they know your style. At least that's how I feel when I'm scrolling through. I kind of know when it's a Young Painkiller photo.
Yeah.
So what inspires your style of photography? There's like so many different ways people can go about taking photos, but what's sort of your inspiration for it?
So a reason why I like a lot of people like can like see my photos and like can like understand that it's my image is because I've created like a film stock in a sense. So like I like really did a deep dive on like color science and stuff like that. And I pretty much made a film stock for my digital camera. So now every single time I take a picture, it looks like it would be one of my images. And then mixing that with like compositional work and all that other stuff, I always shoot, I shoot primarily with like two lenses. So like that's another reason why a lot of people like can like determine like that's Pat's work. So I've kind of like built this whole like idea of like work in like my style off of like what I would like to see, you know. Like I like flirted with like black and white photography for a while, and I was like, it's kind of too cliche. And I was like, it kind of gets lost in the batch of images. So how can I make my images set aside from everybody else's? And my work is very like vibrant, very colorful, but there's like very weird hues. And my film stock really like leans heavily towards darker skin tones. Mm. So it leans very heavily towards the proper representation of darker skin tones and melanated skin tones.
Mm. Okay. And I know you take a wide variety of photos. I know you do portrait style, you do events, you've done corporate work, as you've mentioned. What's sort of your favorite subject to photograph and why?
I really enjoyed documenting street life, just everything from events that are happening in the streets, like Dingus Day, old First Wards, St. Patrick's Day, Juneteenth. I like documenting events like that, but then I also like, I really enjoy just walking the streets, engaging with the community. So walking through specific neighborhoods that like most people don't really necessarily walk down. Our city's full of like so many weird, eclectic, cool mm-hmm. neighborhoods that have so much character to them. Like little Hollywood that's off of Seneca Babcock. Like that's another like weird area that like most people don't even know exists. But like you go into that area and you're like, oh wow, there's so many like cool houses, and like there's like, why is there a bar that's like directly facing like just a brick wall that leads over the bridge, like the bridge that lead like that's on Seneca Street, like it's like, why is there a bar right there? It's like, this is so interesting. So that's my favorite thing, just exploring.
Yeah. I mean, I used to do that as a kid. Like I'm not a photographer in any way, shape, or form. I like to take pictures once in a while, but when I was a kid, I remember like going on my bike and trying to map out the neighborhood on my bike on my own, because that was before, you know, like Google Maps was a real thing, so you had to see where you were going. So I even as like someone who is a Buffalo native, I find that I am discovering new parts of Buffalo based off of your work. So I really appreciate that and the work that you're doing literally on the ground with folks. Are you a Buffalo native?
Yeah.
I'm born and raised here?
I was born here. I lived here until I was like 12, and then I moved down south to the Carolinas, and then came back when I was 19 or 18.
So where are you at now? What's kind of your stomping grounds?
I live in the Lower West Side.
That's my good. Listen, yeah. I like to tell people that I lived on the West Side before it was cool. Oh. You know, and then people were like, oh my gosh, I love being over here. And I was like, you should have been here at the height, yeah, like in the 90s.
When it was lit. Right? Like when there was cool like Puerto Rican spots on every corner and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So like talking about, you know, Buffalo, our neighborhoods and life in Buffalo, what do you see as like the best part of being in Buffalo right now, specifically as an artist or just living in this city?
I think the growth that is possibly happening. So like there's like a renaissance that's happening right now, from like the art scene, but then also to like how things are slowly like building up from like there was like a moment in time that it was just very stagnant and it seemed like it was going down. But now I feel as though there's a possibility of growth, and like there's like kind of like a light at the end of the tunnel. And I see that with like areas like Canal Side, and like when you see like the new parks that are being built and stuff like that. I see a lot of promise here. So I think that's like one of the number one reasons why I am documenting the way that I am so heavily, especially over the past 4 years. Just documenting buildings and structures that might not be here. It might be replaced with something completely different. But I think that, and this is like kind of like it leans into like my addiction with the work, because like it's like Pokemon. I always say that like I gotta catch them all. Because things might not be here. Like for instance, like Volkers is getting knocked down right. now. And like I was able to document that like when it was here. I wish I documented it, like the inside of Volkers a little bit more thoroughly, but I think it's like there's so many cool things that are happening And that's where, like, it's great for me. And, like, the people that are here are just, like, they're, you're never going to encounter a Buffalo native anywhere else. Granted, like, every city has their own, like, weird little quirks and features, but I think that Buffalo has a lot of really cool quirks, and the resiliency of the people that live here is just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, talking to my parents are immigrants to the United States. We landed in Buffalo as, like, our first home. But they see the changes that are happening in the city. And I think for me, it's a little bittersweet where some things are great and I love seeing progress. But I also have, like, a question in the back of my mind on, like, who is it for, right? Yeah. Like, so, like, from your experience being out with folks, working with different organizations, photographing different individuals, I know you've been doing profiles on a couple of folks in the last few months. What's been the vibe from people who have been here, have been doing the work when it comes to progress in Buffalo? Is it generally positive? Is it a little mix of the two?
I think it's a mix of both. So it's kind of like give or take. Like, I'm very like a optimistic person naturally. I'm realistic also, like, I'm very realistic. But the optimism kind of, like, my optimism really is, how do I say this? I think that folks here have like, there's always going to be the optimism of, like, this Buffalo, like, we can make this place look, like, be great again. Or be great. Be great again is crazy, especially in this day and age. But I want, like, a lot of folks want this place to be great. And back before I did photography full-time, I worked for Shared Mobility, which is the parent company for Ready Bike Share, which is our local bike share. And there was a lot of strides to, like, for a lot of folks to, like, push and try and make these places, like, great. And, like, I see it happening, like, slowly but surely, you know? Like, there's a lot of folks that are, like, putting a lot of money into, like, Jefferson and, like, the Jefferson area. And from when I grew up, Jefferson was, like, it was a poppin' area. Mm-hmm. Like, we had the Jefferson Arts Festival and a whole bunch of other crazy cool things that, like, they have block parties. And now they have those block parties again. Like, those block parties are popping off on Fridays during the summertime. So I think there's a lot of great things that are happening. There's a lot of new, fresh minds in this space. And a lot of people that are, like, just sick and tired of seeing the same old stuff happen over and over and over again.
Right.
So I think that there's a lot of promise. And once we start figuring out how to all work together instead of being siloed off, I think that that's when Buffalo will become insanely great. And we can, like, stand up for ourselves so that we don't have, like, gentrification crazily happen crazily here. Because when I used to live down south, it's crazy. Like, I used to live in Charlotte, like, right outside of Charlotte. And when we first moved down there, it would take us, like, 20 minutes to get to, like, uptown Charlotte. Mm-hmm. And it was, like, before it was, like, fully, like, built up to what it is now. Now I get lost when I go to Charlotte. And, like, mm-hmm. I learned everything. Like, I used to skateboard in Charlotte. I used to, like, be in bands in Charlotte. I, like, knew Uptown very well. Now, I don't even know. Like, there's neighborhoods. They're like, yeah, meet us in Noda. I'm like, where's Noda? Like, what's that? They're like, I don't want for that to happen. And, like, I see, like, there's positives and negatives. So, like, there's a lot of money and stuff like that coming into Buffalo, but there are, like, they're trying to change the names of, like, neighborhoods and stuff like that, which is, like, it erases the history of our specific areas. Mm-hmm. Like, when people are calling the east side of Buffalo East Buffalo, it destroys that history of that area. All the nonprofits that are over there that are, like, predominantly, they have East Side in the name of their, in their programming, you're destroying their entire SEO. Like, these are major things. And, like, when you have the Old First Ward, they're trying to name it the Old Neighborhood. And, like, it's just, like, you destroy the history of these areas. And, like, that's where, like, it kind of gets, like, messy for me. Because historically, like, I want for history to last over, like, financial gain inside of an area. Mm-hmm. Like, that's my number one thing.
Yeah, and I mean, the arts play such a huge role in capturing and preserving history, and particularly visual arts like photography do that, because they 10, 20, 30 years from now, somebody's going to be looking at your photo and they'll be like, wow, I didn't even realize that we had a brick bar that was here, right? And that's something, I mean, growing up as a younger person, I didn't ever imagine Allen Street without that building.
Yeah.
But like now looking at it without some kind of documentation, and even artistic documentation in that case, we lose out on that complete history. So I want to talk a little bit about your role as a history keeper, and particularly as somebody who is a black photographer in Buffalo. I don't think there's many commercial black photographers. There's plenty, right? But we don't hear about them so much. I know that you recently did a panel on black and brown photographers in the area. So talk to me about what the scene is like as a black photographer in Buffalo. Is it supportive of your work? Do you feel like you're being seen and heard where you need to?
Oh yeah, I definitely do. I feel it. Just because like I've worked very hard in my marketing to kind of like push my work out there. So a lot of people know me because of the amount of like, in a sense, viral, like locally viral work that I've created. I know a lot of folks don't understand like the marketing aspect of their work, but there's very successful like black photographers here. Like Brandon Watson's very successful in the work that he does. Malik Rainey, also very like promising, and he works well. DJ Carr, another really like talented, well-known photographer that does corporate work also. Like, I wish there was more options and opportunities for us, but I think that like there's just so many photographers that like I think like we're all kind of like, it's a small city at the end of the day. It's a small big city, and there's not that many businesses that like are doing the same thing, but I wish that there was like a more, it was more open market sometimes, in my opinion. Sometimes I wish like people would just like reach out to more people than just having like the same like five people do the same thing over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah. So talk to me about this opening of opportunities. What's like an ideal opportunity for someone like you, who's a photographer, who's up and coming, who's really serious and ingrained in work in Buffalo? What would be like, this is like the best thing that could possibly happen for me as a photographer?
For me, I think like, for me, like, because like I know about like marketing and like social media and stuff like that, I think like a social media job would probably be like the best thing, because like I know how to like, I know how to make something look concise, and I think that like photography like really like hits in a lot of like in a lot of spaces, and then like with the like photography, videography comes like hand in hand. So I think for me, I'm a straight up photographer, but like I know how to make something look like a decent video. But I think that for me, like a social media or like creative director position, something like that would help like substantially. But I think like, yeah, I don't know. There's like, there's so many different options for me. Sure. And like, for me, like with like the work that I do, like I lean heavily into like education. Like I try and like, I want people to like learn how to like do photography at like a very like high level. Because at the end of the day, it's just holding a camera and taking pictures.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there a bunch of, is there like a lot of interest in coming up in the photography world? I'm unfamiliar with photography in Buffalo specifically, so I'm wondering, are you like doing workshops? Are you meeting with people? What's the interest looking like?
That's my plan. There's a lot of folks, like a lot of like younger photographers ask me, and I always tell people all the time too, like I might seem very unapproachable, but like I'm like, I think people like look at me and they're just like, okay, like this dude's very serious about his work, and he, like I smile like very, very rarely in certain public spaces.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, like I want for like this work to, I want for everybody to be able to create images at like a very high level, because I think it will push me and pushes everybody else to be great. So I think that that's something that there's a decent amount of kids that like really want to learn about photography. And I always tell people, hit me up. pull up with me if you want. Follow me at like a follow me at something that I'm shooting. I shoot almost every week. And I was shooting every day for like years before, like for like the couple, for the 4 years before, like I was shooting every single day because I was posting every day.
Right.
But now like I'm chilling out. Like I'm just like, okay, I got to organize all these photos I've taken over for every day.
Yeah.
It's been 166,000. I just counted.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
4 years.
166,000 images in 4 years.
Wow. Wow. So let's talk a little bit about your work, Pat. Like what's been a highlight of recent work that you've been doing? What's something you're really proud of?
So I've been, right now I'm like kind of like, I'm in a residency right now, like a photo residency. So, well, an art residency inside of a gallery space. And in my residency, I've been like kind of focusing in on kind of storytelling in like in a studio space. So it's like takes away the whole entire outside like expectations and like how can I make a story inside of a studio space. So I've been leaning very heavily into like off-camera lighting and like all this other weird stuff. So that's something that I'm like really excited about. I'm also a part of the Portrait of Buffalo through SEPA Gallery. So I was given the Broadway Fillmore District and Lovejoy Districts, and I was documenting it for the past year. And throughout that whole year, I was I learned a lot about myself as a photographer, and like learned a lot about like how to be a decent photographer, like not great yet, but a decent photographer.
Okay, tell me more. Tell me more. What made that experience more of a learning experience for you?
Initially, when I was doing photography, I was taking a lot of photos of like, I was taking photos of formalized portraits, and I was doing street photography, but of like stills, like still lifes. Like, so it was like buildings and like the occasional person walking through the space.
Mm-hmm.
But then like, I was like, okay, during this project, I was like, okay, I need to like learn how to talk to people a little bit better.
Okay.
So, I came out of my like clamshell of like not talking to people. And there's still days like I don't talk to people. Like there's days that like there'll be like a week that I don't talk to a subject at all. But I've learned to like approach people a lot more comfortably. Like, hey, this is what I'm doing. This is who I am. And like, how can we engage in this situation so that like you don't feel uncomfortable with me shoving a camera in your face?
Sure.
So that's one of my like that's something that I've learned like very like that's gonna like go past like any of the stuff that like I've done in the past. So it's like it's helped me substantially.
Sweet. Yeah, I mean, people don't figure if you're a photographer you got to communicate with people, but like we're all subjects in your art form, and I think that's a cool thing is that you're working with like living, breathing subjects that isn't necessarily just like paint on a canvas or music notes on a sheet. Like, people are people, and it's a really cool opportunity. I mean, on our shoot, we got to meet people that I've never met, you know.
Oh yeah, the barber.
Right? Stopping by that barbershop, but I still think about that even though it happened years ago.
And that will do it for this edition of Producer's Picks. We thank our guests, Dr. Marcus Watson, Jay Phillips, Jadon Williams, Deja Middlebrook, LaShawn Davis, and Pat Cray. If you missed anything, or just want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, including the full individual episodes aired in today's compilation. Each episode is online at btpm.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for listening.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members
and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.